The following program is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Welcome to Humanities Connection, a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. America has a love affair with Alexander Hamilton thanks to the Broadway musical. But later on in today's episode, we're going to tell you how you can get a look at one of Alexander's major accomplishments in Paterson, New Jersey. My interview is coming up in just a few minutes with Robin Gold of the Hamilton Partnership for Paterson. But first, a very moving story about the Lost Souls Public Memorial Project. The story we're about to tell you is 200 years old, but it will shock you. New Jersey was the scene of the most notorious slave ring to operate in the United States during the first half of the 19th century. In 1818, a local judge was at the center of this ring. It ultimately sent 144 African Americans from New Jersey into cruel and permanent slavery in the Deep South. These African Americans are called the Lost Souls, and a project is underway to memorialize their story. That's what we're going to be talking about with two guests during this segment of Humanities Connection. Calling into our WFDU studios, Reverend Karen G. Johnston. Karen is minister of the Unitarian Society, a Unitarian Universalist congregation in East Brunswick, New Jersey. And also on the line is Dayan Huff. Dayan is graduate program coordinator and gallery coordinator for the Department of Art and Design at Rutgers University's Mason Gross School of the Arts. Karen and Dayan, thank you very much for joining us here in the program.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for having us.
Let's talk a little bit, Karen, about this story. It really is shocking to realize that a judge in New Jersey, a northern state, was doing something on a massive scale that we in the modern age might only associate with a story like 12 Years a Slave. How was he able to pull this awful, evil thing off in a state that had technically, I know it was phased out, but technically outlawed slavery many years before?
Well, that's the thing that we're finding out, and that actually is quite known if you go looking just a little bit, is that there was a time period in our country where something called the Second Middle Passage took place, where, in fact, 835 million African Americans who were either in the northern part of the South or were in the northern states, people who were free, people who were still enslaved, were sent down into the further into the Deep South. And this is, as far as I know, one of the most atrocious examples of that. Judge Jacob Van Wickle, and I don't say his name often because what I hope is people will remember the Lost Souls rather than he.
You notice I didn't mention his name in the beginning. It really is the idea. We have to say it for historical context, but the idea of memorializing this person is abhorrent. I get it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So he was able to use his power as a Middlesex county judge and use his home in East Brunswick, it was referred to as a slave castle, to keep captive, actually what we're finding out so far is 177 African Americans, some of whom were free, some of whom were enslaved.
So as the research grows and continues, you even find more examples of this.
Yes, about a year ago we did our first recitation of names in a public setting, and we knew 85 names. 3 days before that happened, on that day we knew 95, and right now we know the names of 144, but we also know 39 individuals who were on a ship called the Bliss, but we don't have their names. We just have the manifest.
Was
ongoing research.
Was this judge doing something which I'm not justifying it if it were legal in those days, but was this illegal? Because I think it would be even worse if the law actually protected his ability to do this.
There was at a time a law that said that someone could consent to being sent south. But my understanding is that law ended actually before 1818. So it was a combination of a loophole in the law, but also an abuse of the power. And there's one story that's told where a six-week-old, whose name was Regina, that she was brought into his house, which was used as a kangaroo court, and he directed his questions to her and said, would you like to go to to the south, to the Louisiana, and this baby, a six-week-old baby, cried, and he said, I take that as consent. And then he turned to her mother, who was standing next to her, and said, your daughter's going. Where are you going?
That
of course,
is awful.
This is a terrible, terrible choice for a mother to have to make.
Just absolutely awful. I mean, that has all the trappings of Sophie's Choice, and we don't even know about this, which is why a memorial is needed. So, Diane, you are a person who's trying to make sure that this memorial is done right. What are some of the choices that you have to make? I guess, first of all, the very medium itself, right? Whether it's a sculpture, whether it's a painting, whether it's a living performance, whatever it is. How do you even decide what the medium is going to be?
Right. Well, that's, I mean, it's a multi-part question. It's multi-parts to even get to that point. So working with the steering committee, we've been actually going out into community groups throughout East Brunswick as well as New Brunswick and Highland Park to hear directly from residents upon telling them this history, to learn about this tragedy in a way that for most people they never heard. There's no notion within their minds that this is even a possibility. So even before we can talk about the physical work, it's important for us to get the initial reactions and how we can manifest those emotions into something physical. So I think we're open to not just one type of memorial, because one way of honoring all of these individuals isn't enough. So I think, as Reverend Karen was mentioning, the recitation of names, so this performative component of regularly or annually reading the names as a means of embodying their spirit is one way of memorializing them. But then also trying to create a tangible, permanent fixture is something that we're also in discussions with. And we actually were partnering with the Department of Landscape Architecture and a few of their students with the support of a design for public history project, where we had these students, Jacqueline DeValue and Minik Song, create their own concepts for memorials using our history, the history that we shared with them. And so they both created physical sculptures that were incorporating sound, that were incorporating the architecture of the time period as a way of trying to embody the spirit of these souls. And we shared those initial designs with the public, and then with that, used that as a jump-off point. So we've had everything, you know, the importance of sound. So it's thinking about Louisiana and being on the marsh, and so is it the sense of a wind chime or the wind with a sense of farming, or is it important to hear a physicality of being on this of being on a ship and thinking about the steel and the sound of steel, and or is that a connection to drums and you know the origins of African Americans coming from Africa and using drums as a means of communication? So it can go in all these different directions, and it's a question of, I think one of the most important things that we took away was the importance of the physical presence of people, and not having this abstraction of just a plaque, but for people to come to, if it's a physical place, to come and know that these were 6-month-olds, these were 13-year-olds, these were 33-year-old people.
Right. Humans. You've got to be able to express the horror of all this, and that these people had no power, and many, I would assume, many of the adults had not even learned to read or write at this point, so they could be manipulated that way. But the children and the babies, that's the worst part of it. Now, Dayan, do you have a physical location, at least for a spot, regardless of the medium that you choose to use artistically? Is this going to be indoors, outdoors? Where's it going to be?
I think the goal with the committee thus far is hoping to have a physical presence outside in East Brunswick. We are in, you know, we've started conversations with the city council to see if possibly being a part of the larger municipal park that already has a number of memorials, and being a part of that conversation. So I think ideally it would be an outdoor space. But I don't think we're even at that point yet. I think right now the importance is awareness and ensuring as many people know about the story as possible, and then getting their feedback about what needs to be an experience. And then the challenge of having a public memorial, and how are people going to be able to, how will they respond to come across in a public space a memorial honoring a cruel act upon humans? And then the question for viewers is, like, are we complicit in this?
Right, right.
How do we respond? How do we react? How should we feel?
Right. It's so much more. So much more than a history lesson. I'm just going to move a little faster here because we're running out of time and there's so much to talk about. First of all, Karen, let us know, since this program is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, what role the council did play in getting what is called an incubation grant going. That means kind of a startup phase of a grant. What is the role of the council?
We are so filled with gratitude for the blessing of the incubation grant, because it's really allowed us to spend this year planning and not needing to rush into what would have been a far too small memorial, and to engage the community through not just here's a vote, but getting their input, as Dayan was describing, getting a sense of what it is that we can truly honor this event in history. And so we have been, we've had two major events. We had a Day of Remembrance in December. We're having on May 22nd our second recitation of names, including with a collaboration with State Theater New Jersey's poet in residence, Glennis Redman, where we will be reciting the names, as well as we've commissioned her to create new poetry inspired by the lost souls. But we are also going to be able to create a real website. Right now we have just an amateur's version, and the beginning of the curriculum, so that we can get the words out, so that we are there for folks to learn about, as well as eventually a memorial. If we had to rush into raising money right away without having a clear vision of what this memorial would be like, we would not have been able to honor.
Right. You wouldn't be doing it properly. Something would be missed, or the power of this, the clear key here is the proper central message. And Dayan, you sent me a list of questions that you do ask of the people trying to get a sense. And one of them is, as a potential visitor to the site, what tone or mood should the site provide? What are some of those choices of tone or mood that might be expressed?
Right. And I think depending on who the visitor is, it's going to be a different experience. So for a number of the people that we met with who are you know, white, it's this question of being complicit. Should we feel a guilt in knowing that in some capacity we are the ancestors? And we did actually find out there were some people that we met with that had, because of organizational affiliation or regional affiliation, feeling a connection to the Van Wickel side. And so this question of how can we right this wrong?
And right, there's even a street name for Van Wickel down there, isn't
exactly,
there?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And then for African-Americans to not know once again that a history that is so complicated, and our role within this country is so complicated, to then see a memorial that acknowledges that this was a wrong, and acknowledging also that we're trying to fix it, it's an empowering moment. But then it's also once again heartbreaking that there are more individuals who have no names that were victims during a very problematic time in our country's history. So it's the full spectrum of like release and grief, but then also this possibility of we can right wrongs, and
right,
we can acknowledge that we were at fault and try to figure out a way of moving forward.
Right, and it could even have a message for the 21st century, even though it's so
exactly.
much later. I just want to mention, because we're down to only a minute left in this segment, but this program is initially broadcast on WFDU in April, so this event coming up on May 22nd certainly is something that those listening to the initial broadcast could take advantage of, the annual recitation of names on May 22nd. However, for the website, for when this goes on the archive, just a general take-home message, Karen, about this, the importance of the Lost Souls Public Memorial Project.
Well, our nation continues to grapple with racial wounds, both past ones and ongoing ones. And if we are to turn away from them, we will continue to be harmed by these wounds. But when we remember what's happened, when we remember these lost souls back, this is part of the healing that this nation needs. And so I'm really proud to be a part of this, and I welcome more and more folks to support us.
This is an amazing story that people throughout the United States should know about, and I congratulate both of you on giving your time to making sure this happens. And I thank you very much for both being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Reverend Karen G. Johnston and Dayon Huff on this segment of Humanities Connection, talking about the Lost Souls Public Memorial Project. You're listening to Humanities Connection, a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. This program is broadcast on 89.1 FM, and then it's archived at www.njhumanities.org. And you can go to that website to find out about all of the interesting things which are done by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, as well as hearing archives of Humanities Connection. It's been called the Silk City and the birthplace of American manufacturing. I'm talking about Paterson, New Jersey in Passaic County, right in the heart of our WFDU listening area. This is a city people pass through on Route 80 and may not know that it is central to the history of the United States of America. Well, maybe they will as a result of the Hamilton Partnership for Paterson. That's the subject of this segment of Humanities Connection. And my guest on the phone right now is Robin Gold, the program director of the Hamilton Partnership for Paterson. Robin, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about, since America has an obsession with Alexander Hamilton, thanks to Lin-Manuel Miranda, of course, but we do, and Alexander Hamilton really made Paterson the kickstart location for American industry. Tell the audience about that background and the role of the Great Falls in that.
He did, and we're very happy that Lin-Manuel Miranda has brought such attention to Paterson's founding father. The story really begins in 1778 when Alexander Hamilton and George Washington were retreating from the Battle of Monmouth, and they stopped at the bank of the Passaic River for a picnic lunch, and they were sitting under a big oak tree, and they noticed this amazing waterfall. They actually wrote about it. Washington's aide, McHenry, wrote about it in his journal, and he wrote about what they had at the picnic. They had ham and tongue and biscuits and grog. And they
coming back from a battle, that seems like a pretty good stash that Washington
right.
and Hamilton had.
Right. So they sat by this waterfall, and they noticed it, and then they went on their way. They didn't even camp there. But then several years later, when Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury, and he wrote this report on manufactures, which was his outline for how the American economy could thrive on industry and manufacturing rather than just agriculture, he was looking for different sites around New Jersey and this area that they could use for this city that would launch American industry.
I guess hydroelectric power was a natural.
Yes.
If you haven't seen the Great Falls, it is really impressive. It is one of the most powerful and largest waterfalls in the Northeast, in North America, pretty much, right?
Yeah, it's the second most powerful waterfall east of the Mississippi.
Wow. That's amazing. And now there's a national park there, but let me just mention what the name of the actual project is. It's called East to West, Experiencing Paterson's Multicultural Past, Present, and Future, funded by our underwriter, the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, with additional funding from the National Endowment for the Arts. So what exactly are you looking to do here in terms of having the Hamilton Partnership?
So this is a really interesting project, and it's so unique to Paterson because, as you mentioned at the top of the segment, Paterson is called the Silk City. And this is because Paterson was, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, the world's largest producer of silk goods. Not the raw silk. They would import the raw silk, but Paterson had the most silk dyeing plants, silk weaving plants, jacquard plants, and they would manufacture silk goods and export them all over the world. And so it became known as the Silk City. And we like to call Paterson the last stop on the modern Silk Road. The Silk Road, the original Silk Road, as a lot of people might remember from their history classes, was the ancient route of material and cultural exchange throughout the east and then, you know, from China throughout Asia to Europe that existed back in, you know, I think from maybe the 10th to about the 14th centuries. I might be wrong on those dates.
But you're talking about places like Como, Italy, and in France and in England. And I guess the last stop is Paterson because of the hydroelectric power. Is that why these mills were there? Is there a connection there?
Yes. Paterson became this city of industry. It's really the first American city of industry because the Great Falls were able to provide this free, renewable energy to all of these mills and factories.
Now, I know that the Great Falls is already a national historical park, but part of what you're doing with the Hamilton Partnership is to enhance that. How are you going to make this something better than it already is? What are your goals there?
Right. Well, we work with the National Park Service on educational programs, on events, and right now we are starting to plan and design a new visitor experience center for the Great Falls, which will explore the educational and interpretive themes of the park, including this modern Silk Road theme.
So you have the South Main Street tour, something called Savor Paterson, the modern Silk Road exhibit. Tell the audience a little bit about some of the specific tours and events that are going to be part of what you're doing here with this grant, which is called actually an action grant, right? You're already in action on this.
Yes. So right now we currently have an app called Mill Mile. It's available on iTunes and on the Google Play Store, and it's a self-guided audio walking tour of the national park. We are going to add to that with a self-guided audio walking tour of Paterson's South Main Street neighborhood. This is the area of Paterson that is populated mostly by Middle Eastern immigrants, first-generation Americans. There's a lot of Middle Eastern culture there, and we want to explore that as part of this east-to-west connection.
And as far as savoring Paterson, that's going to be having some of the food and taking advantage of some of the restaurants and other places?
Yes. In 2016, for the National Park Service Centennial, we did our first Savor Paterson Multicultural Food Festival, where we had 12 restaurants from around the city come to the park and offer tastes of their food. And so we are going to have our second Savor Paterson Festival this year as part of this East to West project.
I had mentioned at the very beginning of the segment that America's obsessed with Hamilton because of Lin-Manuel Miranda, but there's actually a connection here to what you're doing with the Hamilton Partnership and also the Broadway show and other aspects of America's real love affair now with Alexander Hamilton. Talk about that, please.
Yes, so we have been working with the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History and the Rockefeller Foundation. They have this amazing initiative that they launched in New York City and have been doing in other cities, where they have a curriculum that they introduce in schools. The students work on their own creative project based on history, and then the students get to go see special matinees of Hamilton for $10 a ticket and workshop their projects with the cast of Hamilton. And we have been able to expand that project to Paterson and have Paterson Public School students participate and then go see Hamilton for this low ticket price and participate in workshops with the cast.
Talk a little bit about the Visitor Center. This is something that you mentioned to me as we were doing pre-interview preparation. Mm-hmm. What you want the Visitor Center at the Paterson Great Falls National Historic Park to eventually be?
We hope that the Visitor Center at the Paterson Great Falls will be the starting point for a visitor's exploration of both the national park and the city of Paterson. We know that many people are not familiar with many of the great things about Paterson, and it's hard to know where to start when you come to the city. So we hope that a visitor will come to our new visitor center, get a sense of what the city has to offer, explore some of our amazing exhibits, learn some of the themes, then go out and explore the park and explore the restaurants, the shops, and the history of the city.
I think you've answered my next question. I was wondering, you know, I love history, so even if something is just a history lesson, I think that's good enough in itself. But is this more than a history lesson? What does this have to do with 21st century Patterson? But I guess the idea is revitalization, right? If people are going to the restaurants, they're coming here, they're having a new view of Patterson, that's relevant not just to our knowledge of what Patterson was, but could have something to do with what Patterson is and is going to be.
Absolutely. Patterson has such a bright future ahead of it. There's really so much that Patterson has to offer. And our goal with what we're doing here, the Hamilton Partnership, is not just promoting a national park, but we really, with the national park, with the visitor center, with everything that's happening here, we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to transform this image of Patterson into a place where people can visit, people can study, they can live, shop, dine, work, and invest.
Now, the industry that so dominated Patterson because of the Great Falls, that's probably gone, right? We're looking at a different future for Patterson, a good and a positive future, but we're not talking about bringing back necessarily manufacturing.
No, and that's for most of 21st century America. Manufacturing is not coming back to the cities that were once, you know, prosperous for manufacturing, but there are other industries here that are, I think, going to thrive. There's an animation studio here. There are companies that make products for SpaceX and I think airplanes.
I guess some of the buildings, right, still can be retrofitted because of the fact that they're spectacular buildings with huge space and lofts and just that solid look of a building from the Industrial Revolution.
Absolutely. There's so many buildings in Patterson that are being adaptively reused for offices, for residential purposes. I myself work in an adapted old building that's been turned into an office.
What's important to me is that the listeners here at WFDU, of course, this will also go as an archive on njhumanities.org, but for our listeners now, how they can take advantage of what the Hamilton Partnership for Patterson is doing. Because this is an action grant. You're in process already. Give our audience members some examples of how they can take advantage of whether it be the South Main Street Tour, Savor Patterson, Modern Silk Road Exhibit, or any of the efforts to really build up the Visitor Center. What can happen now? How do they get in contact?
The first thing that I would say all of the listeners need to do is come to the Patterson Great Falls National Historical Park. If you haven't been, you definitely need to come here because it's amazing. If you've been before but you haven't been since you were a kid, it looks completely different and you need to come. Our South Main Street Tour will be launching probably in the summer. Before then, you can use our Mill Mile walking tour. You can download it right now. Our Savor Patterson Food Festival will also be happening this summer. And our exhibit will be launching when the Visitor Center opens, but we hope to have a preliminary exhibit in the Patterson Museum before that. So keep your eyes and ears open for what's to come. And again, the best thing you can do for us to show that, you know, the park needs everything we're doing is to just come here.
Sounds great. I've been there. I want to go back there, and I thank you very much for taking the time here to explain it all to us on the program.
Oh, thank you.
Robin Gold, Program Director for the Hamilton Partnership for Patterson. That's it for this episode of Humanities Connection. I'm Bob Mann. Thank you very much for listening. This program is initially broadcast on WFDU 89.1 FM, and then it's archived at www.njhumanities.org. You can go to that website not only to hear archives of our program,
but to hear about all of the fascinating programs that are being run throughout the state by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities.